Now, let me just quickly say, as many of you know, under the leadership of Professor House, the Development Policy Center has become, by all means, a central hub for development policy debates in Australia. It covers a wide range of issues, ranging from aid effectiveness, development challenges in the Pacific, and increasingly so, which I'm particularly pleased about, political economy of reform and political development more broadly. So really issues and themes that are at the forefront of current development debates. It's in this regard that I'm particularly happy and pleased today to have three distinctive speakers that will shed some lights on public expenditure and financial management in fragile states. Issues, again, that are critical by all means, but particularly, of course, in these challenging environments such as fragile states, post-conflict environments, and so on. So it's my particular pleasure then to welcome Marcus Manuel and Alistair McKechnie, who both work for ODI's Budget Strengthening Initiative, which is an initiative which places a team of international experts close to governments in fragile states environments. And Ed Hedger, who is really the head of the CAPE unit, which stands for the Center for Aid and Public Expenditure at ODI, and who will present his joint work with the World Bank in post-conflict countries. I should say just briefly that the last time Ed and I met was, in Kigali as part of the African Budget Directors meeting, which is part of the quite remarkable African Collaborative African Budget Initiative. And I guess over a couple of beers or so, we had fascinating discussions about what the future of PFM holds. And we also discussed quite intensively the idea of having greater exchange between ODI and Crawford staff. So I must really say I'm particularly delighted to see him and his colleagues here today. And I look very much forward to sharing this fascinating panel on public expenditure and public finance in fragile states. Before we start, just quickly the ground rules for all three of you. I would suggest that each speaker has about 10 to 15 minutes, and then we keep about 30 minutes or even a bit more for question and answer. So without further ado, join me in welcoming Marcus, Alistair and Ed to the Crawford School.
Thank you very much for your introduction, and it's a delight to be here. We're going to be talking today about some of the work the Overseas Development Institute has done in many different countries around the world, but we're also looking forward to the conversation afterwards, because we're conscious here in the region you've got some of the most challenging countries that you're trying to engage with and support in public financial management in Papua New Guinea and the Solomon Islands, so we'll be interested in hearing your views too to what's happening. For those of you who just don't know, the Overseas Development Institute is Europe's leading independent think tank on international development and humanitarian assistance. And we were very pleased to be ranked number two in the world to Brookings as the first. We're over 50 years old. And our mission, as you see down below, is both to inspire and to inform policy. And directly about talking about poverty and livelihoods in developing countries. We have 12 broad programmes in the Overseas Development Institute. We've now grown quite a lot, so if you knew us 10 years ago, you probably wouldn't recognise us. We have 200 staff. One of the largest programmes is the one that my colleague Ed heads up, which is the Centre for Aid and Public Expenditure. We also have a very large programme now on climate change and climate knowledge network. We also have, actually, in the audience, Marta, my colleague, who heads up the Politics and Governance Programme. We do a lot of work on political economy around many of the developing issues that's faced. And we have a large group on humanitarian policy, just to give four examples. We then have a couple of flagship programmes, which, in addition to doing research, are actually also focusing, in my case, on the Budget Strengthening Initiative, on advisory support. The development progress stories are financed by Gates, which I'll talk a bit further about in the presentation. And finally, some of you may know us through the ODI Fellowship Scheme. Indeed, it's very nice for myself to be back in the Pacific. I started my career in development in Fiji just after the first coup in 1987. So my sort of experience of fragile states go back quite a long way. So that's the background, and we're very happy to talk about the ODI more generally if people want to. But on to the budget strengthening initiative. When people say to me, you know, why are you so interested in budgets? I feel like the question that's asked to the bank robber, you know, why do you go and rob banks? Yeah. To which the answer is, well, that's where the money is. And for those of us working in development and concerned about reducing poverty, the issue is less and less about aid, as we all know, and it's more and more about countries' own resources. So working around the budgets and getting the budgets to work better, to our mind, is one of the best ways of accelerating reduction in poverty and also accelerating the exit from aid, which I think we're all collectively trying to get out of this business as quickly as we can, because this is not something that anyone wants to be around doing in the long term. So what do we do? Fairly straightforward. We provide policy advice, we provide work on implementation, and we provide research as well to these countries. What we were trying to do is this new initiative is see whether we can be providing technical assistance in this area in a better way than we've managed to do beforehand. And we're piloting this concept in three countries, South Sudan, Liberia and DRC. And we've got under consideration three other countries, and in fact I'm flying to Myanmar tonight. We're also in conversation with Afghanistan and in Somaliland, and actually last week with Somalia as well. So the aim was, can we provide technical assistance in a better way, but also can we provide technical assistance for the countries that need it the most, which have the least capacity, face some of the most challenging issues, and actually many of these countries are starting to have a substantial amount of their own resources, you know, through natural resources that they're starting to exploit. What do we do? One of the very traditional things, you go around, you find the champions, and you recognise that the champions in most of these countries are working flat out. That's a picture in the middle of Agritisa Sabuni. I spoke to him. He has worked for 4 years, 7 days a week, 24 hours a day practically, trying to run the budget in South Sudan. Someone like that could use a bit of spare brain power, so use a few extra arms to help him out what he's trying to do. So one of the people we provide him is the person on the left, is the minister's advisor. This person went to college with John Garang, the former leader of the South Sudan, and worked with the South Sudanese over the last 20 years, including training them in the bush as the Antonovs were literally dropping the bombs around the rebel camp at the time, through to a more stable situation and through to independence in South Sudan. So someone who's got an incredible strategic background, and the minister said, I want this person to continue to advise me. I didn't want him associated with any particular donor. Could ODI finance them in that way? And that's what we've done. At the other end of the spectrum, in a sense, is my colleague Sheila, who is Ugandan, has worked in the Ministry of Finance in Uganda for 2 years, and she is helping them just put together every month the reform plan in the Ministry of Finance, just discussing the nuts and bolts of what are the policy issues they're going to try and focus on, and how to actually develop the institutional capacity of the ministry. One of the things we've done was just connect them up to the internet so that they could all start using electronic diaries, which I think is probably going to be one of our greatest contributions to the efficiency and effectiveness of the South Sudanese Ministry of Finance. But the point I'm making on this is that what we go in is an offer, you know, here is $1 million for this year, what do you want to spend it on? The donors have trusted that ODI will, you know, make sure the choices are sensible, but the choice really very much is you. So as long as we think it's sensible, you don't then have to go through a long process of, you know, having terms of reference conducted or anything else. We can just say, okay, we'll agree, we'll do it, and we'll do it tomorrow. The other thing we do is, you know, helping around budget reform. That's a very happy Liberian Minister of Finance. He was appointed with just 18 weeks left before he had to present the first budget for the government post-election. He came in saying, I have a poverty plan I want to implement, I've got a president who wants to implement a national vision, and I've got no extra resources from donors, what can I do? And so one of the things we do is went through forensically through all the line items for all his ministries and identified savings amounting to something like 50% of the total budget, which he could then reallocate across to his priority programmes. So that's why he's looking particularly happy, because I think when he started 18 weeks to run, he thought he wasn't going to, this was going to what would happen next year, not this year. I'm picking up. I might need some. Thank you.
Not sure.
questions.
Another aspect we helped on, very traditional, transparency and accountability, citizens' guide to the budget in Liberia, helping Ugandan's parliamentary budget office. It's the larger budget office, in fact, in sub-Saharan Africa. And also, interesting, how you can use mobile phones to disseminate information around the budget process. Again, fairly traditional activities, but things that just need to happen. We've also been doing a lot of peer learning, and we've actually have a formal MOU with the South Sudanese government of Uganda, about facilitating very high-level exchanges between the two ministries. Uganda obviously next door, and lots of Ugandans come up to South Sudan, so there's strong cultural links already. And this, again, has ranged from sending the very junior accountants to go and work shadow their colleagues in Uganda for a week, through to organising a very high-level retreat, which took all the senior management of the ministry into Uganda. And they had a very interesting conversation. The first question they wanted to know was, is there any way in which I can persuade, you know, the former chief commander of the defence forces to actually accept a budget constraint now we're in a civilian government, which the answer is yes, but you've got to be really careful about how you do it. We also do, one of the things that this is, we found is an interaction on research and policy in the process. So in the bottom left, we started off with a conference with the IMF saying, what's the role that public financial management reform can do in accelerating the transition out of fragility? As you say, we are really obsessed about budgets and what they can do. We genuinely think they can do this as well. That then led on to a piece of research that my colleague Alistair produced on Afghanistan and how some of the processes and procedures they adopt in Afghanistan, which aren't actually being imitated in Africa, could actually make a difference. We then turned that into, developed that further into a piece on innovative aid instruments that got taken up in the preparations for Busan and got picked up in some of the stuff, the New Deal in Busan that you may have heard of, and that's Ban Ki-moon commending the New Deal to everyone. And we've continued working with the G7 Plus group of countries, and this has been 1 year on. Your Prime Minister, President of Indonesia, what's not there is actually the Prime Minister of Timor-Leste, who's just seen one further on, which I think is quite an interesting combination to have on the panel, and President of Liberia again. All talking about how to do things better in fragile states. And the other point, those two people, two of those three are actually on the high-level panel advising Ban Ki-moon on what should be the post-2015 agenda. This research policy feedback, another thing we've been working on, we, for some years, have been struggling with issues around budget support and issues around sector budget support. And really, frankly, why was sector budget support not delivering what everyone hoped it would do? And what's come out of this idea of the missing middle, that, you know, donors talk to people in ministries, but still don't actually change anything's happening on the ground. So, done that research. The same people who did that research 3 years ago are now actually in South Sudan working very hard to try and say, okay, how can we make sure this doesn't happen again in South Sudan? We get it right. And there's a constant interaction. At the same time, we've also been thinking much more about the politics of it, so working with Martha's team about how does the politics play into this, but also how does some of the public financial management issues play into it, basically accelerating the decentralisation of public financial management in South Sudan, accelerating and working with donors to how to get them to start to use country systems. The feedback so far, people really like the fact we're independent, we're neutral, we're not one of the donors. We're not for profit, we're not a consultancy, is something that people also have liked about the way we approach things. The fact we're demand-led, which is really important. I mean, in a country like South Sudan, we'd go in on the morning and say, we've come here to do our midterm review of the project. And they say, well, that's very interesting, but I just heard today that actually the oil revenues aren't going to start for at least another 3 months, so actually I've got another 3 months of austerity budgeting to do, so could you help us with that instead? Yeah, okay, fine, we'll do that. Not quite what we planned, but, you know, that's what we want to do. In these fragile states, because the capacity is limited and the crises are pretty extreme, you need to be able to go in and be able to turn around immediately and respond to what's the one issue that's preoccupying what the ministry's having to deal with. The other thing that's been very striking, frankly, is that people don't want our ideas. We thought going into this that that's what we're short of, and the answer is no. There's no shortage of ideas, and actually the people dealing with this actually know what they want to do, but what they don't know is how to implement it. And that's actually what they want to support on. So, as we've sort of said, tell us what you want to spend the money on. Actually, we spend much more money on implementation support than we have on idea generation. They like us because we're fast. They like us because we're quite catalytic. Because it tells us what we get donors to change their behaviour around. Various things about the style of where we work and the fact we're confidential. then just three or four really sort of very high-level messages about what we've concluded from this. And this draws directly again on the political economy analysis. And this is a quote from the political economy analysis that five different research programs. Now, as academics, I'm sure you appreciate the idea that five different academics from five different institutions to say in one sentence the same thing about something as high level. This is quite an interesting, you know, sentence in its own right. But the realization that when you're dealing with something, particularly as political as the budget, it's actually very difficult for someone like the World Bank to come in and advise. And that's difficult for two reasons. First of all, they don't want to share with the World Bank necessarily all they're doing, because the World Bank might not be happy with all they're doing, and they are slightly embarrassed about maybe some of the things that are missing or not quite right, and therefore they'll want to tend to hide some of the stuff and not share with the World Bank. And we know in some countries they've been given access to much more detailed budget information than they were prepared to share with other donor TAs, simply because they were worried about the donor TAs linked back to their own donor, you know, the World Bank, UN, or whatever the agency was. So they hide information. The other thing they do is they tend to say yes. So if the World Bank TA advisor comes and says, I think you should do that, they think, okay, this is the World Bank, don't want to piss off the World Bank, sorry, language, but, you know, yeah, of course, yeah, absolutely, we'll definitely do that. That's very, very important, you know, thank you for advice, and we'll, you know, do that. And 3 years down the line, we wonder why it's not happening, because they never really owned it in the first place, and they didn't have the capacity to do it anyways, but they didn't want to say no, because you can't risk, you know, having a disagreement with such a large donor. So it is inherently impossible for donors to come in and give advice on some of these political areas. And this is what this article is saying. So where there is a need to support, you need to de-link that as much as possible from the money. Because as soon as you introduce money into the equation, you've changed the politics of that relation at any rate. Now, it's not impossible, but it is actually very difficult. The other thing that's been really interesting is the power of telling stories. The Gates Foundation asked ODI to put together stories of development progress, because they felt partly that the narrative in the US was very, very negative about failures and about famines and, you know, children starving, and this was the only understanding. And they say, actually, there's much more interesting stories out there. So we did. So we commissioned, we wrote various stories about success, primarily aimed for US politicians, and it's proved very useful. It's been useful in the UK as well. Just to remind you, there is progress. But what I hadn't appreciated was taking the story of Cambodia to South Sudan. And I just told the story about this Cambodia education. And the thing they took away was their program in education reform, they only had two qualified teachers left alive in Cambodia when they started it 20 years ago. And look where they've got to. And they think, well, actually, that's our problem, because actually we think we've probably got 10 in South Sudan. And we just don't think, how can you turn that into an education system to deliver education for 3 million kids? Yeah. The answer is you can do it. And that was a much more powerful story than going in and saying you've got these 33 things wrong with your education system and you need to fix them and it's all hopeless and how can you possibly do it? And it gave them real encouragement about what they could do. And I hadn't thought it would happen, but that's been quite interesting, you know, learning for me. It's been quite interesting listening to governments talk about donors. And they say things to you that they don't necessarily say to the donors' faces. When you talk about animals, the governments are very keen on cheetahs. They want it to be fast, particularly in fragile states. You've really got to get going. There's so much needs to be done. And you want, you know, wise sort of elephants, you know, the sort of thing that you would probably want if you're doing an animal association game. Unfortunately, the model that basically happens in our experience is tortoises, which are quite nice and friendly, often. And they, you know, if you feed them nicely and you're nice to them, they will smile and they'll eat your lettuce. But they ain't got speed. And there is a real problem, you know, and this is essentially what lies behind the New Deal, which says that no conflict-affected state is going to reach the MDGs. Also, it has reached the MDGs, and that's why the New Deal, we need to do something, because we can't keep on doing business as usual, keep providing tortoises. It's not the appropriate animal for this circumstance. Another thing which I, again, hadn't thought about at all, I've been working on budgets in Treasury and DFID for 20 years, was actually we spend a lot of time looking at the wrong things. Typically, donors come in and say, we're going to finance your health, we're going to finance your education. In a post-conflict country, these are the five things they want you to do first. First of all, they want you to worry about the politics. If you haven't got a political settlement that's going to work, if you aren't helping finance politicians coming together to work out what that political settlement is, it's all going to go pear-shaped in 5 years' time. We know the greatest risk of conflict is in the immediate period after conflict. But how many donors go in and think, the first thing I want to talk to you about is your politics inclusive and how can I support you in doing that? I didn't know any donor. Second thing, security. Well, that's a bit more. They're used to doing that. You know, UN peacekeeping forces, it's a bit more familiar. Justice. No, that's not been particularly high on anyone's agenda, partly because it's very difficult, and donors like to do the easy stuff, not the difficult stuff. But again, there's this profound sense of injustice in the society, you're risking a return to conflict. Jobs for all, well, we've been saying this for a while, but actually I'm really struggling to find a donor programme that trumpets more than we managed to train 200 hairdressers. I mean, the scale is wrong. It's 200, it's not, well, actually there's 2 million underemployed people in this country, what are you going to do about that? So, you know, the scale is wrong. And finally, resources for all, particularly being transparent, particularly saying, are the resources moving from the centre to the periphery? Because often central periphery has been the cause of the conflict. If you don't sort that out, you're going to see a return to conflict. So, again, different sorts of sets of agenda and priorities than we previously thought about. I'll leave at that point. I'm happy to answer questions later on, but I'll turn over to my colleague. Professor. Thank you.
Thanks, Marcus. I'm going to talk about implementation because as Marcus mentioned, the Budget Strengthening Initiative showed that the capacity to actually implement budget, to implement development programs, is one of the big constraints in countries that have just come out of conflict. And there are several reasons for this. I mean, one is first deciding what ought to be done. And there are some sectors, for example, electric power, which is inherently complex, which governments get lots of conflicting advice and really coming up what are the real priorities for investment are difficult to do. Second point is that often the cabinets in a country that's come out of conflict are divided, and there's this political settlement that pulls people together, and taking collective decisions is difficult. And it's a collective action problem. Procurement is often based on a set of rules imposed by various donors, and within these donor organisations, often overseen by some kind of high priesthood. And this is often too complex for fragile situations. On the other hand, rushing in and doing lots of sole source procurement can also be a recipe for governance problems in the future. And then once there is a contract in place, managing that is often quite difficult as well. I mean, contractors may want to reduce the amount of cement and concrete or overcharge for variations in the work, and putting arrangements in place both within the government and those who support the government becomes quite important. What we've found is that targeted technical assistance to countries can actually help governments plan and take decisions. But it's important to know that these decisions are not strictly technocratic. There's a political aspect to them as well. But nevertheless, analysis that at least kills off the white elephants can narrow the range of choices and focus the political discussions. The second point we found is defragmentation is one way of getting around the problem of limited capacity in countries. And some countries have been very successful in having national priority programs that consolidate the effort, that reduce the management costs, that reduce the transaction costs of dealing with lots of little donor projects, and also achieve more results. Third is fixed procurement, which is pretty obvious, but working on using country systems. In our view, the issue is not whether to use country systems, but how to make country systems work and how to manage the risks of using them, the risks of money going astray, but also the risks that no results will be achieved. And one way of doing this is to actually contract out fiduciary services procurement, accounting audits in the short term, while building the permanent capacity in parallel. In the case of Liberia, there was a government that was really upset about the slow implementation of projects, particularly in infrastructure. And I think the World Bank's World Development Report on fragility and conflict showed that governments didn't have to do everything, but they did need to demonstrate at least a few results to the population to generate confidence that things had changed. And in the case of Liberia, we recommended that they put together an interministerial committee, select 5 or 10 key projects or programs that are important, and then monitor them and make sure they happen. And they've actually gone ahead and done that. The other way, the important instrument for dealing in situations of fragility is the pooled funds, the multi-donor trust funds and similar arrangements. But it's important to note that these are not just pooling funds, they're also pooling risks. And these funds reduce the transaction costs of dealing with multiple donors, their missions, their reporting requirements. And I think one example I can give, in Democratic Republic of Congo, there were 200 projects in, I think it was the health sector, 300 projects, 30 donors, and 200 of these 300 projects were less than $2 million. And this is a government that had very low capacity that had to deal with it. So pooling projects together, pooling money makes sense, and also putting the government's face on programs. If there is the objective of external support ought to be to strengthen legitimate authority that is or a state that is perceived as legitimate in the eyes of its population. There's also a problem with bilateral donors in that the time needed to achieve results in a fragile situation is many multiples of their electoral cycle, and it's very difficult for countries to essentially stay the course for the decades that may be necessary, particularly when there are politicians in the donor country who understandably want to be associated with successes and see results. And again, pooling is one way of managing these processes. Let me move on to some of the design features for successful pooled funds, and we've done some research in BSI on this. I mean, I think I mentioned the risk sharing, but the risks are also being shared to the administrator of the trust fund. That's usually a multilateral organization such as the World Bank, Asian Development Bank, or UNDP. Usually these funds use the country systems to some extent, but they can also contract out fiduciary services, or in other cases such as the Liberia health sector, is what's known as a dual key approach. So it uses country systems, but key decisions on procurement, on expenditure of money, have to be signed off by the government and also some representative of the pooled fund administrator who sits in the ministry alongside them. We found that in cases where pooled funds, trust funds didn't work, it was very often a governance problem. So, for example, the donors could be involved in micromanagement of those funds, in a sense in their kitchen, assisting with the cooking, but then they have an accountability role in saying, well, the food's not very good that's coming out of the kitchen, and clarifying these arrangements becomes important. We've also found that sometimes donors don't put the right staff in the country, people with seniority and experience, which in some ways are needed more in a fragile situation than in a country which has lots of capacity and pretty much knows what it wants. There's also an issue of how the administrator for trust funds gets set, and we recommended to the Sudanese that they actually ask for bids from particular administrators and then evaluate them with some help, perhaps from some of the key donors. And then there is the issue of the humanitarian actors who are delivering development services, and what should be their relationship to the government, particularly when they're recipients of what are in effect public funds. We would argue for some contractual arrangements to do that. Now, what does all this mean in practice? I'd like to give some examples from Afghanistan. In a previous life, I was the manager of the World Bank's program in Afghanistan from 2002 right through to about 2008, I think it was. And this led some interesting lessons. First of it was a case where the international partners were willing to take risks because it was of Afghanistan was of geopolitical significance to them. Now in some small Pacific Island country, some small African country, they may not have that luxury, and that's, I think, an issue. Also, some partner organizations really aligned behind government programs and had this organizational coherence right from the very top of the organization right down to the lowest level, and others completely bypassed the government. And some of the other research we're doing showing that one good way of destroying institutions in a country is to ignore them and bypass them. We found it possible to identify islands of excellence, reforming ministers who we could work with and really achieve quite substantial results. Building on the capacity that exists within the country, particularly at the low level, many fragile situations have very strong communal kinship-related organisations that can be built upon, and also there may be non-state actors who have experience in delivering services, for example, health, that can somehow be integrated into more permanent and more sustainable arrangements. Getting the mix right between short-term results and long-term institution building is important. I mentioned defragmenting investment, supporting the government to do coordination, because the best coordinator, in my experience, is a sovereign government. The various attempts at elaborate architecture among donors to coordinate assistance, in my view, rarely work. I mentioned the quality of people, and the ninth point is question the ideologies within donor organisations. For example, in Afghanistan, we decided to finance industrial parks, whereas all the private sector developments people said don't do that. But industrial park got around the issues of availability of land, security, infrastructure, which were major constraints to private investment in the Afghan situation. The last slide I have is how do you bell the public procurement hat? I mean, this is procurement. Everybody says is a problem, and I've already talked about the temporary arrangements that can be put in place, exploiting the flexibility that exists in donor procurement rules. In the case of the World Bank, we use procurement designed for dealing with natural disasters. The United States government, for example, has a get-out clause in what are rather Byzantine procurement rules, which said that they can all be overruled in matters of national interest. We didn't waste a lot of time putting new laws in place, particularly as there was no capacity to implement them, and really the legal framework wasn't the binding constraint. I think it's also important to look at how does public procurement affect the local private sector. In fact, a lot of talk by donors about private sector development is really about how do international companies invest in a country, rather than how do you nurture the local private sector, particularly the private sector that's competitive, that's reasonably small scale, and public procurement and design becomes really important in that. There's also the issue of corruption risks and how to manage them, and I can talk more about that in question and answers if you like. But it's important to note that, and I think the lesson of Afghanistan is there may be lots of other money coming into the country that affects corruption. In the case of Afghanistan, it was narcotics. There was also military expenditures, which often operated under a different set of rules. And I think it's important to make sure that obsession about money going astray doesn't mean that no results are achieved. And it's a possible theory to have the most perfect procurement financial management audit rules, but they're so impossibly complicated that there are no development results, which I would argue is a reputational risk for the partner, the international partner as well. So how to balance that, I think, is a real issue that we might want to come back to. In the case of Afghanistan with the trust fund, we actually had something called ineligible expenditures, which we just wouldn't fund, and the government had to use its own scarce resources, unless, of course, we found evidence of fraud or corruption. And the final point is Afghanistan was somewhat unique in that they actually insisted that UN agencies receiving money that was on the government budget had to have a contractual arrangement. Sometimes it involved competitive bidding, and this was rather novel and has really only been done in Afghanistan, and I actually think led to some really quite outstanding performance by some UN agencies. And let me stop there. Ed, over to you.
Thank you, Alistair. Thank you, Bjorn, very much for the introduction. I'll be brief, partly because I think Bjorn's heard this presentation twice before, at least, and partly because I want to allow plenty of time for questions. I'm going to try and attempt a sort of a fairly violent summary of a piece of work that we spent about 2 years doing, jointly with the World Bank and ODI, where we asked the question, what really has worked across 8 countries in terms of efforts to reform public financial management? And trying over across those 8 countries to look over a sustained period of time and to understand what across the full spectrum of the budget cycle had shown some improvement and what some of the explanatory factors were there. The countries you can see there, ranging from Afghanistan, Cambodia, Congo, Kosovo, Iberia, Sierra Leone, Tajikistan, West Bank and Gaza. I regret there isn't a Pacific Island country among them, but one of the points we can pick up later is that question. What you'll see is they all have a time period of approximately 10 years of reform experience or reform opportunity post-conflict that we examined. They're all post-conflict fragile states. And there was some surprisingly strong progress in a couple. Substantial progress we recorded, we found in Afghanistan, Kosovo, Sierra Leone, West Bank and Gaza. That was an unexpected finding, given that the literature talks about the profound challenges of institutional and public sector reform in post-conflict countries. The WDR, World Development Report, 2011, talks about time periods of 10 to 40 years to achieve much change, much reform. So this was worth exploring. I'm going to now just take a little bit of time and talk about 2 things. One, what some of the apparent drivers and factors underlying this reform seem to have been. What were the significant factors across the countries? And secondly, to discuss where some of those reform, what some of the reform domains have been, what some of the priority, the areas which have shown greatest traction. After, I'll try and tease out a few policy pointers, perhaps, a few policy implications for discussion. So, motivationally, institutional legacies. There were quite a mixture, looking across Cambodia and its multiple influences, Francophone and so on, Kosovo and the Soviet basis, Francophone also in DRC, but also strongly Anglophone in elsewhere, such as Sierra Leone. Didn't seem to make a particularly significant correlation between or significant effect on underlying reform. Low capacity was not a binding constraint. The immediate expectation we have is that the profound limitations on capable staff and absolute capacity would be fundamentally limiting on reform. In fact, a lot of tactics, particularly deployed by the donor community around capacity substitution, capacity supplementation, successfully enabled particularly central finance ministries to achieve relatively strong performance, key reform progress. There are big questions about the sustainability of those reforms and big questions about the role of external advisors in line positions. But the finding was not that it significantly compromised the reform possibilities. Government motivation, on the other hand, was a driving factor. There are 2 parts to this that I think are worth talking about. One, the external incentives and motivations upon domestic politicians to prioritise PFM particularly in the public sector reform domain. And secondly, the role of those politicians in a domestic context in spurring reforms. Much of this is often billed or bundled into a heading of political will or political commitment, which is rather unhelpful analytically in trying to explain progress or reform achievement. We attempted to explain what that meant. PFM reforms were taken by some countries as a key demonstrator of state capability and reform capability and reform progress. And there seemed to be some evidence across most of these eight countries that where governments were committed to demonstrating that they were serious about reform, getting their PFM reform up and running early was quite important. Related to that, HIPC debt relief and the eligibility for that and drivers was one particularly important area. Contrast that with the domestic demand side. We find that there seems to be relatively limited pressure, or relatively pressure that local politicians felt to pursue reforms. Ministers of Finance were a particular factor here, and it might be a point to discuss in the Q&A around perhaps some of the Pacific regions. But here, particular individuals were instrumental in reform efforts over particular periods of time. Many of the finance ministries finance ministers themselves in the more progressive reforming countries around PFM were former IFI senior staff and directors themselves. They were people who were fluent interlocutors with the international community, people who were often tasked, it seemed, by the president with keeping the flow of money coming, making sure that there was a sufficient public financial management environment such that the country was credible externally in some of the basic quality of financial management. The trouble is these people don't stick around. They're there for a short period of time. It suggests windows of opportunity, but it also suggests isolated champions of reform. We're taught by implication about donors and external development actors in this place. The reality is that they were influential, but they were most influential actually in the composition of reform programmes. We've found, Alistair has talked a little bit about, and so has Marcus, about the role of donors in framing the reform agenda. The initial picture in most post-conflict fragile states that we covered, that we looked at of the first period, is something akin to sort of disorganised chaos in terms of donor coordination. There are a lot of competing multiple missions, a lot of different reform agendas being proposed from the supply side. Not a lot of coordination. Competition, duplication, contradiction of approaches were rife, we found. The coordination mechanisms start to come together around joint assessments. Some of those joint assessments are simply sort of multi-donor joint assessments. Some of them, such as sort of I suppose rather famously in Cambodia, are much more joint with government. A point, though, that is I would like to sort of dwell on for a minute is the role of government in setting its agenda. Found that most countries were not well positioned to articulate their own agenda for reforms, but those that were seemed to be privileged in their ability to push through and achieve successful reform. I was struck by Marx's comment in his presentation about the shortage of ideas. I would suggest that our evidence found that it wasn't always easy to tell whether the government had ideas or didn't have ideas, because the space for ideas was almost immediately crowded out by the external community and external action. That space was populated and colonised with best practice solutions, or if not best practice solutions, then other people's solutions. We therefore examined in two ways the reform content. One, the technical solutions, the technocratic solutions. The second, the strategic capability of finance ministries to develop and articulate their own agendas, to prioritise their own reform action plans, and then to try and deliver upon those. And we think that's a rather critical ingredient of reform success across these countries. Let me just take a 2 or 3 minutes just to wander through reform content. We delved in considerable detail about which particular reforms across which domains of the budget cycle seem to get most traction. This is really rather important because in many of these countries we see a plethora of reforms, upstream medium-term expenditure frameworks, performance budgets, programme budgets, downstream treasury single accounts, if-misses, a litany of good practice ideas, but where do we actually get traction? The legal framework up front didn't seem to be critical. across most cases. This was a controversial finding, given that the canon literature around the IMF, for example, is get the formal rules, the formal laws in place, and practice will follow. Not so in the cases we looked at. There were opportunistic progress on practical reforms, on actions, which were often then wrapped up and consolidated into reforms of the legal framework. And that reverse of the received wisdom was really rather important. Organisational arrangements did seem to matter. DRC is a particularly good case in point. There are currently, I think, three different ministries covering the public finance sphere. At one point, there was one under a heavily politically supported minister who had strong international links and was well-versed in dialogue with donors on PFM reform, and he was able to make quite rapid progress over a limited period of time, which then went away when they split those ministries. Budget formulation was quite a challenging area, it seemed, in most of these countries. Basic budgeting and getting the basic budget up and running was clearly a priority in most countries. Not all of that was on an annualised cycle. In some cases, 3 months, 6 months, just working out a basic plan over a short-term period for what's going to be spent and executing it was clearly a priority. By contrast, the efforts around putting the budget on a medium-term footing, creating a stronger programme structure around the budget, linking that more formally to results, just simply doesn't seem to have worked in these cases. And the challenge that most countries seem to face was the capacity pressures it places upon them to attempt these rather more ambitious reforms. So there are two factors both working here. One is whether some of these standard canon reforms are applicable given context. The second is the risk of diversion of scarce capacity and effort against these reforms. Contrast that with budget execution. We expected to find a story of limited success of mis-executed budgets. The contrast thing, the things like Treasury single accounts and some basic automation and computerisation was a consistent feature of reform success. The Treasury single accounts example intrigued us because standard thinking would be this involves multiple actors. It is about reducing control of line ministries in favour of central authority. And in the context of a fragile state with multiple poles of authority and a lack of strong central leadership, this might be particularly challenging. On the other hand, it seemed to have worked, and we can talk a little bit about what the lessons there might be. Oversight was and formal accountability mechanisms were a marginal feature of most reform programmes. They were not immediately or early trumped by the international community, and they tended not to be a main focus of domestic reformers. In many cases, public accounts committees were not functional, even if they sat. Audit functions were often outsourced, and I know from the expert understanding from talking to people in AusAid that that's also quite a relevant feature in the Pacific region. One final point on the core focus of the research findings. This was a story of focusing on central finance ministries, central finance agencies. Efforts to deal with the quality of public financial management, the quality of budget management at sector and subnational levels lagged quite significantly and quite substantially. The focus at central level didn't happen early. This, I think, probably resonates for most of us with the experience we have, where people crowd in on a central ministry of finance, and that's where the focus is, because that's where the money is. It's also, of course, where the agenda around fiduciary risk and central fiscal control emerges. We found that this seemed to be a missed opportunity, not also thinking about sectors at the same time and the quality of public finance, because the dual focus with service delivery and other aspects of the subnational agenda was perhaps lost in the context of PFM reform. So what are a few things that we might take away from this, a few things we might put on the agenda? No standardisation in sequencing. The question I find often most asked is, what does this tell us about how you should sequence your reforms? The disappointing response is, on the one hand, not much, but on the other hand, everything, because it tells us there isn't a blueprint, there isn't a standard. Your PIFA toolkit will not tell you the answer to this question. There is a lot of variety and a lot of different possibilities, and the argument we would make is an engagement that gives space to reformers to think about their priorities and to articulate their reforms around this that considers some of the contingency factors in the country context, allows non-standard, heterodox, and sometimes counterintuitive sequences which might work. The second is substantive point is around the incentives for PFM reform and what we mean by political commitment. Avoiding treatment of that phrase, political will, as some residual is pretty cool, and equally avoiding a rather narrow view that you need it and if you don't have it you can't do anything is important. The point on from an actor-centric sort of sense of agency around this is who are the winners and losers, what are the incentives, international as much as domestic, around the reform agenda. What is expedient here? Why? Who will set to gain in terms of continuing flows, in terms of burnishing credentials international, in terms of the credibility and the contribution of PFM and good PFM to make the state look effective and to genuinely be more effective is very important. This is 4, 5 and 6, repeat what I've said already. We can see relative progress on budget execution, relative lesser progress on some of the advanced aspects of budget preparation, and a lagged prioritisation around the need for legislative reform formally. Final point on Endron is the connection with wider public sector reform. We chose to focus on core public finance issues, but we did attempt to contextualise that in the wider public sector reform agenda. We know from much analysis that PFM reform is often the poster child of public sector reform, and it's the area that seems to get the results and people think it's going to happen. But, of course, it is critically connected to the issues of public sector pay, salaries, decentralisation agenda. In many of these countries, there was an ongoing process of redefining the constitutional arrangements, of looking at the nature of sub-national and central government relationships. Many of those were seemingly frozen and intractable. And the extent that this gave some sort of pathways into grappling with issues is quite important. On the public sector pay issue, there were the critical issues about the affordability of supercharged capacity, where and the payment of salaries in order to capable to attract diaspora, but also, of course, the critical issue of the extent of the budget spent on the wage bill and how that could be grappled with to free up fiscal space for other priorities. I'll leave it there, and I'd be very interested to take any sort of questions or challenges about how that applies to this region specifically.
Fantastic. Well, thanks a lot, and apologies, we are a bit late in terms of time. So what I would suggest is what we do is we collect 3 questions and then let the panel respond to it. So volunteers to the forefront. I just abused my position here very quickly. I just want to make a very quick comment here. Marcus, just listening to you, it seemed to me occasionally you painted a very rosy picture here of a very competent ODI advisor who's neutral, who sits in the ministries, is appreciated, delivers hands-on advice in a pragmatic fashion and so on. But clearly we're talking here about environments that are highly clientelistic, highly politicized, often very personalized. So I guess the quick reflection and question I have for you is, how do we deal with outcomes that are second, third best? And what does it really mean for being an advisor? Are you suggesting that our role should be that of a facilitator rather than that of an advisor in these kind of environments? Now, with that, questions? Is anyone who wants to... Yeah, right over there. Oh, sorry. You go first.
So maybe I'll speak. Okay. Margaret Callan from the Dalton Policy Centre. I have a question that two of you touched on. One, I think, Edward, you said that there's no evidence that demand-side pressures are important for accountability of the government or for pressuring government to improve budget processes. But in the introduction, Marcus, you mentioned some of the work that you provide in Uganda is a citizen's guide to the budget. So I'm interested to hear a little bit more about what those, please.
One more question.
Hi, very nice to see you, Alistair. I'm doing a PhD on the role of foreign aid and state building in Afghanistan. I've been working in Afghanistan with the Ministry of Finance on budget in 2004 and 2005, and it's very painful to go through this process.
Really,
and very politicized as well. My question is to the panel that, and coming to the budget, in terms of definition of budget, the key problem is in terms of what's budget, because it's not like when we are talking about budget, so we are talking about all the resources that it comes to a country, whether foreign aid or other grants or whatsoever. Coming to the case of Afghanistan, national budget, or what we call it, on budget, only represent 20% of resources or financial resources. When we are talking about public financial management and its impacts on state building development or so and so, how do you see that kinds of the factual deficiencies? And
Can we wrap it up, because there are probably more questions?
Yes.
Yeah. So can we just have the panel respond?
Yeah. The structural deficiencies of budget, and also the problem with aid architecture, because aid management can, in these countries, cannot be isolated from the whole architecture within aid context.
Do you want to take some more questions now? That might.
Well, okay, so, but really one or two more questions and then we have to run.
Ron Duncan from Crawford. Just two points really. One, I don't hear anything much about what I call KISS budgeting, that is keep it stupid, simple, stupid. particularly in the Pacific, I mean, with enormously limited bureaucratic abilities, you know, you just can't go for anything with any deal of sophistication. The other point is, I've noticed that it's always easy to reform the central agencies. Everybody wants that to work efficiently, but where all the grand corruption is out the line ministries, and that's where the big men and whatever who, you know, get into that game want to go, and that's what's really important. It's how do you control expenditures.
All right. If there are no other questions, I think. Yeah, one more.
Yeah. Oh, well, I'm just intrigued by the distinction you made both yesterday and today about the distinction between budget execution and budget formulation. I've long been of the opinion that budget formulation is for the comfort of donors. Whereas budget execution tends to be for the comfort or for the delivery of aid. But you weren't very specific about what you meant by budget execution support. And I'd be quite interested to hear some more specifics about what you meant by that, because you know, we'd very much like to sort of get into the granularity.
Okay, fantastic.
Could
I
go first on the answer and come to the mic?
Yeah.
Thank you. Let me just, mindful of time, I'll attempt some quick answers, but I'm pleased to sort of pick up detail. Demand side pressure, I promised a violent summary, it seems I didn't achieve that. I think the reality we found was that it simply wasn't the dominant pressure upon reformers. That's a difficult finding because I think many people are heavily invested in the demand side. Our conclusion on that was that, not to say it's unimportant, but more to think it's an important slow burn in the background, but it isn't going to be the factor that really drives reform in these contexts in that time period. I'd be pleased to sort of talk more, but that would be my quick summary. I wouldn't want sort of take from that that we registered it as unimportant, but just it was relatively insignificant as a driver. On keep it simple, stupid. If we could have a second subtitle, I think I'd happily adopt that for the report. We did find that in the sense that in 7 of the 8 countries, for example, medium-term expenditure frameworks were tried again, failed. I'm not saying that means there's no place for them. I'm just simply saying as a segment of the evidence, we didn't find that they were successful in 1 or 2 cases. They were detrimental to that. My nuance on that is that the implementation of an MTEP is a piece of technique that is often promoted externally. What is missing sometimes is a dialogue about what is the government's reform intent what are its priorities, and to what extent would putting the macro-fiscal forecasting on a medium-term basis be useful to that? To what extent is there a sort of political appetite to negotiate the priorities around the budget? So the evidence on certainly the upstream budget formulation, very much keep it simple. Where we were surprised was that the level of possibility and ambition on some of the issues around budget execution, I'll come to that, suggested relatively greater progress than we might have expected, and that probably explains the substantial finding. But sorry, I wouldn't disagree at all with you. Line ministry expenditure control. Two things. First of all, we didn't have the luxury of looking in detail at that sector picture. We think that was quite an important omission from our research, but we just didn't have the time or the budget. We think it is very important. In the early period, there was a strong centralising and controlling instinct around the domestic actors as well as the international partners around this. Obvious reasons about why donors would be concerned with fiduciary control at the finance ministry. But equally, the Ministry of Finance was looking to reduce decentralised control, particularly line managers and social fiscal control. I think this partly comes into the question about budget execution reforms and why things like, for example, Treasury single accounts and basic automatisation and basic fiscal reporting started to emerge relatively strongly. There's a lot of detail in the report. I'm pleased to share a copy with you and could pick up afterwards on what some of that meant. What didn't get much traction were things like some of the procurement reform, which was still profoundly challenging, some of the other issues around commitment control were also quite problematic and external, as we've heard. But
thanks. I'll take the question about aid that doesn't go through the budget and aid architecture and what to do about that, because these were huge issues in Afghanistan. And I think what aid that bypassed the government, the budget did, was fundamentally disempowered the government of Afghanistan. And I think when the history of the latest international engagement with Afghanistan is written, this will be one of the things that will come out. And for example, the Afghan Parliament had to review the budget, and as the questioner said, this was only 20% of the resources flowing to the country. So the Parliament would huff and puff about how much money in the budget was going to this region and that region, but the other 80% was being programmed on completely different grounds, disempowering what was the legitimate authority in Afghanistan. Now, I think that one of the reasons for this, I think, was true, was that because the international engagement was so intense, there was a massive problem of coordination within the partner governments. I think in the United States, there's something like 12 or 14 agencies involved in supporting Afghanistan, and I've visited Solomon Islands and Ramsey. I think it's got sort of aspects of that as well. So if coordination within a donor partner is a real problem, bringing in an extraneous party like the government, let alone other donors, becomes an additional complication. And I was always staggered to the way some donors did manage the aid. Now, there are solutions to this, and I think one is if some donor can't actually put money on budget, through budget, they can at least have it recorded in the budget document. So there is one document which shows the resources flowing to the country. However, this is not as easy as it sounds, and I suspect one of the reasons why donors are reluctant to do this is that it would actually reveal the costs of a lot of bilateral assistance. And some of the other work we've been doing on putting aid through into local institutions shows that there are huge cost savings in having local organisations and actors being responsible for implementing programmes, particularly in a post-conflict environment where security might be an issue. So although getting this stuff recorded is a worthy objective, I think it will be much more difficult in practice, and it may also raise the issue of who's the donor accountable to the Afghan Parliament or to the Parliament of their own country. So it's a simple idea, but more complicated in practice. On the AD architecture and the coordination idea, I just think that's another story that will come out of the engagement in Afghanistan, the extreme difficulty of coordination. And I would argue that coordination is essentially impossible in these situations unless the government does it and the partners respect that. Which means I think governments have ought to use the power they have, and they don't always realise they have it, and telling some donor to go would send a strong signal, particularly if the value added from that particular programme was not very much. I think the defragmenting both the number of projects and also the number of donors is important, and I know the OECD DAC does publish information on donor fragmentation, and you get these countries where 10% of the aid is delivered by 90% of the donors at huge transaction costs. So encouraging some specialisation among donors, except when they offer some unique knowledge or expertise, is something also that I think the international system should encourage. But I think coordination is a unsolved problem, and I don't see any real movements ahead in improving that, though my colleagues may disagree with me if they wish.
No, I agree, I'm pessimistic about that as well. Just to finally say, on painting a rosy picture, I think we were surprised by how successful we've been across all three countries. We thought that at least one wouldn't work. But we have had the luxury of picking countries that we think it might work in. So I think that's why you're getting a rosy story there. But I like the word. I think facilitation is a very good word of, I think, what we're trying to do. And often you might give advice and it takes a year and then it gets picked up on. We're trying to push it forward before it's before it's ready. Generally doesn't work. Much better to work at the pace that the government wants to work at and achieve more effective reforms. Thank you very much indeed.
Well, thanks a lot. Please join me in thanking...